Good morning, everyone. So last class, we discussed how to decompose the Einstein equations into constraint equations and evolution equations. But it actually turns out that we still have more work to do and to put these into sort of a mathematically well-behaved form. So before we go into that, I want to make a brief digression and kind of review the different types of partial differential equations or PDEs. Different types of PDEs have different mathematical properties and they're associated with different physics. So in physics, we kind of have three canonical PDEs. So those are the wave equation. So here I'm just going to consider functions that are functions of two different variables, but of course you can generalize to more. So that's the wave equation, and it's sort of the canonical hyperbolic PDE. We'll sort of see where that name comes from in a second. The second one is the Laplace equation. And that's sort of our canonical elliptic PDE. And the third one is the heat equation. And that's the canonical parabolic PDE. So, and here I've kind of, used the usual physics notation where we think of this wave equation as giving us an evolution in time, right? So I have the time variable here. For the wave equation, we can set some initial conditions for our wave. For u and its first time derivative, and either let our domain be infinite or put some boundary conditions where our domain ends, and then this hyperbolic PDE tells us how things evolve forward in time. In contrast, this when we have elliptic PDEs in physics, we usually they're not evolution equations. For example, if we're solving for the gravitational potential in Newtonian physics of some matter distribution, or we want to get the electrostatic potential associated with some charge density, then we have a Laplace-like equation. And there we just we put in some boundary conditions. And then kind of intermediate between the two, we have the heat equation. Where, so in the in the wave equation, information sort of propagates with some finite speed, but in the heat equation, we still have some notion of evolution, but things kind of propagate infinitely fast, right? If you start with a delta function distribution, it becomes some Gaussian like immediately, right? So we can write down sort of the general linear second order PDE and then try to classify it into these three different categories. Okay, so in general, we can have different coefficients in between sort of all the second derivative terms, including the mixed ones and the first derivative ones. But basically, what one wants to do is sort of, in some sense, complete the square, and one can show that basically, depending on, so basically, in order to classify the PDEs, we're just concerned with the highest derivative terms, so all the second derivative terms, and the lower order terms won't matter in terms of determining their character. If the coefficients satisfy this property, basically we can introduce new variables. So basically that means that this is a hyperbolic PDE, and we could introduce some new variables to write it in this canonical form. Where it's like the wave equation and then some lower order terms, which just involve first derivatives. If this is equal to zero, we can basically kind of, get rid of one of these terms completely and just write it as just one partial derivative plus lower order terms. And then if we have the opposite sign for this term, that's the general definition of elliptic. And again, we can put it in this Laplace-like form. But even within, I guess a little bit later in the lecture, we'll talk about solving the constraint equations, and we'll sort of work to put them in this elliptic form, where we get some like Laplace-like equations that we can solve. But now we're going to talk about these hyperbolic equations, the evolution equations. So it turns out that even within being hyperbolic, one can sort of distinguish between sort of weakly hyperbolic and strongly hyperbolic, and those have different mathematical properties. So before I tell you exactly what that means, let's write down a set of linear PDEs for some vector u. Now u is a vector. And here A and B are some matrices. And we'll show in a second. So basically, we can rewrite any second order PDE in this form. So we'll do that explicitly, for example, for the wave equation, the Laplace equation in a second. But basically, the sort of the character of the equations is going to be determined by the properties of this matrix A, which is in front of the derivative term. In particular, if A has all real eigenvalues, then we're going to say that this equation star is weakly hyperbolic. And if A has all real eigenvalues and it also has a complete set of eigenvectors, then I'm going to say this equation is not only weakly, but is also strongly hyperbolic. And it turns out that being strongly hyperbolic is equivalent to something called well-posedness, which basically says that if we consider some initial conditions and then consider some small perturbation around those initial conditions, that basically our answer isn't going to change by some arbitrary amount. So to be more precise, if we look at the norm of our solution, as our solution is a function of time, then it should be bounded so if we look at subsequent behavior of our solution compared to like the norm of the solution compared to the norm of the solution at some initial time, then that should be bounded. And here k and alpha are some constants that are independent of the initial conditions. So basically, we can consider solutions that they grow exponentially. That's fine. That's physical. But they basically shouldn't grow exponentially with some kind of arbitrarily large constants that are, yeah, there should basically, the physics should tell you what these constants are if it exhibits exponential growth. And well-posedness here turns out to be equivalent to strong hyperbolicity. So we'll see in a second some examples where you don't have strong hyperbolicity, and then you basically can small perturbations can grow arbitrarily fast. All right, so first of all, let's rewrite the wave equation in this form. So we can do that by introducing, so we basically want to get rid of all the, so we can do that by introducing this vector u and say the first entry is just this the scalar wave function u. And then the second one is the time derivative of u, and the third entry is the spatial derivative of u. So this is called putting the equations in first order form. So we're basically introducing new variables so that we only have first derivatives. And then Our wave equation with this definition could be written the following way. Okay, so if we kind of stare at that for a second, we can realize it's the same as the wave equation. Basically, like there's kind of one non-trivial entry which gives us the wave equation, right? Which is when we take the time derivative of the middle entry. Then we get basically we pick out this spatial derivative of the last entry, which is gives us two spatial derivatives here, and then we get zero here. So that's just the wave equation. And the other two entries basically just give you the sort of recover the definition of these two things, right? So this is our matrix A, and we're interested in computing its spectrum. So if we calculate the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, we get the following as eigenvalues 0 plus or minus 1, and then the eigenvectors. So one of these is that doesn't propagate is basically the constraint that we got by going to this first order form. But then we have two sort of physical degrees of freedom that propagate with speed plus or minus one, which is we're assuming the wave equation with speeds equal to one. And these are basically the two characteristics where we have this equals constant, and then and this equals constant. So basically the left moving and right moving waves. Okay, so that makes sense, and we can check, we have real eigenvalues and we have a complete set of eigenvectors, so the wave equation is strongly hyperbolic. Which is reassuring because that's kind of our canonical example. So instead of that, we can consider what happens if, so this is the wave equation. So what if we repeated the same thing for the Laplace equation? Or basically just switch the sign. We can use this same definition for u, but A becomes the following. So we just switch the sign here, right? But then if you try to solve for the eigenvalues of this, you get imaginary ones. So the Laplace equation is not even weakly hyperbolic because it's an elliptic equation. And you know, we can see that if we, you know, someone handed you the Laplace equation and sort of, you know, instead of setting right in terms of spatial coordinates, change one of them to time coordinates, and you try to think of it as an evolution equation, you'd quickly run into problems, right? Because basically, you can have solutions of the form e to the omega t plus I omega x, and we just like if we consider a very high frequency solution, you know, make this very high, we can basically, you know, ignore this last term here, right? Because when you get derivatives, we get this extra power of omega, and we have solutions that blow up exponentially. And we can make this omega as large as we want, right? Consider an arbitrarily short wavelength or high frequency solution, it'll blow up arbitrarily fast. So this is something that's called like frequency dependent growth. And notice that like omega isn't like a physical quantity that's like bounded by some property of the equations. So that shows that you know, also violates this well-posedness condition. Right, so finally, let's consider. So we consider something that's strongly hyperbolic. We consider something that's elliptic and then not even weakly hyperbolic. So let's consider something intermediate that's weakly hyperbolic but not strongly hyperbolic. All right, so here's a linear PDE with just two variables, u and v, and if we calculate the eigenvalues for this, we get just one eigenvalue. One, and has multiplicity two. So that, you know, that means it's at least weakly hyperbolic. We have real eigenvalues, so don't expect to have this like exponential frequency dependent growth. But we do have something sort of, and so I should say the eigenvector is. So it has just one eigenvector. So it doesn't have a complete set of eigenvectors. And therefore isn't strongly hyperbolic. And you can show that it actually has solutions of the following form. So we can plug that in and check it's a solution. So it's not blowing exponentially; it's just oscillating. But the problem is that these coefficients do exhibit polynomial frequency-dependent growth. In this case, linear growth. So again, we can get a solution by making omega as large as we want, and that means that the solution will start to grow arbitrarily fast. So in general, for considering, you know, one physical solution, we could always add this high frequency solution to it, and you know we have linear equations. So some some arbitrarily small perturbation can see this, and it can go arbitrarily fast. So for that reason, this well-posedness or strong hyperbolicity, you know, is really a requirement to sort of make sense of some classical evolution equations. And also, it's something that you need if you're going to try to take these equations and, for example, put them on a computer and solve them or something like that. Because again, you can imagine, you know, you're always going to have some small numerical error. And if you have frequency-dependent growth, it'll see that, and that'll just start running away. You won't be able to get any meaningful solution. Yeah, and yeah. So I think in the tutorial today, you'll so we wrote down the ADM evolution equations. But it turns out, in some cases, those are only weakly hyperbolic and not strongly hyperbolic. So typically, people don't actually use those to do evolutions. So in the tutorial today, you'll basically do some additional manipulations on the ADM evolution equations to put them in the form of what I call the BSSN equations, which do have better hyperbolicity. And then probably next lecture we'll discuss an alternative way to formulate the Einstein equations that's kind of puts them in this manifestly wave-like hyperbolic form, and it also gives you a well-posed formulation. But in general, for equations like the Einstein equations where you have constraints, you have a lot of kind of freedom in how you formulate the evolution equations. You know, for example, you can always take the constraints and you know add them or subtract them or some function of them to the evolution equations to try to put them in different forms, as well as the freedom and sort of what you consider your gauge degrees of freedom and what you consider your evolved variables. So any questions on that before we start talking about initial data?
I didn't follow your argument about omega growing very large and needing large omega.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, like here, like this is a solution for any value of omega, right?
Yes.
So in particular, you can make omega as large as you want, which corresponds to like a very high frequency solution. So you can imagine. You know, if I have some solution, this is kind of like the physical solution or solution I'm interested in, you can make a sort of arbitrarily small perturbation to it by kind of making the coefficient in front of this arbitrarily small, but then make it arbitrarily high frequency, and that extra perturbation will, you know, then blow up arbitrarily fast. Here it'll be exponential. Here it'll be polynomial, but it'll still be kind of as fast as you want. So that's what ruins this well-posedness.
I see. So this is about part of the solution dissipating. If you have a complex part.
Yeah, well, yeah, in some sense, like when you have real eigenvalues, then like for the wave equation, then these just oscillate, right? But when you have imaginary eigenvalues, then yeah, basically because you know that this these are the eigenvalues of this matrix A that sits in front of the partial x term. That means that you get solutions like this where there's not an imaginary part here. There's just like a real exponential growth.
Okay.
All right, any other questions about that? All right, so for the rest of the class, we're going to talk about the initial data problem in GR. And so in particular, I'd be interested in, you know, I claimed last lecture that, you know, if we have some initial data that is some solution on some, you know, hypersurface, call it t equals zero, and it satisfies the constraints, then we can just use the evolution equations to evolve it forward, and the subsequent solution that we get will still satisfy the constraints on every time slice. But that still leaves the question of, like, how does one actually guarantee that we start with some solution, some initial data on some hyper surface that satisfies the constraints. And so this goes by the name of the initial data problem in GR. And if you're interested in a reference, a good one is chapter 8 in the 3+1 lecture notes I mentioned previously. All right, so we're basically, for this initial data problem, we have two goals, which are kind of somewhat at odds. So the first goal is, you know, we want a solution of the Einstein equations, because that's our physical theory. So we want to basically, you know, choose some spatial metric and some extrinsic curvature such that our constraint equations are satisfied. So let me write those again from last class. All right, so does everyone remember what this one is called? Anyone? That's the Hamiltonian constraint. And what about this one? Momentum constraint. So we have one scalar equation and three components to the spatial tensor equation. And just to remind you, this E is the energy density we can get by projecting a stress energy tensor. And PI is the momentum density. So we get this with these two projections of the stress energy tensor. So goal one is solve the constraints, so we satisfy the Einstein equations. But goal two is that we want to, you know, choose these gamma ij and kij to correspond to the physical system we're interested in. You know, so for example, if we want to describe, you know, two black holes orbiting around each other with some given masses and spins, then we want to choose these to represent that. If we want to have a star that's about to collapse, then we need to choose those to approximate our physical system as closely as possible. So the usual approach to this is to basically divide our metric degrees of freedom into two different groups. And one we'll call the free data, and those would be the ones that we specify, that we choose to correspond as closely as possible to our physical system. And then we'll have constrained variables, which will basically solve some equations to determine, and basically these constrained variables will guarantee that we satisfy these constraint equations. So the sort of challenge here is we want to choose these free data variables to sort of be the ones where the physical interpretation is the most clear, but also we want to choose them such that when we write down the equations for this constrained data that they have these nice mathematical forms. So for example, like probably a bad way to do it would be, you just choose like some specific components of the metric tensor, like, say choose the gamma xx and the gamma yy, and then solve the equations for the gamma zz or something like that. But when we get these equations for constrained data, we want to have them have a nice mathematical form. In particular, we want them to be in this kind of manifestly elliptic form, where they look like something like a Laplace equation, and then we can solve them similar to how we solve the Laplace equation, specify some boundary conditions, and then solve them. So just to count these degrees of freedom, so we have for the constraint equations, we have four conditions here, one here and three here. And how many degrees of freedom do we have for gamma ij? Well, yeah, for the space. Yeah, for the space-time metric, we'd have 10 because it's 4x4, but it's a symmetric one. But here we have a 3x3, but symmetric one. So that's how many?
Six.
Six, yeah. And then for Kij, how many do we have? Yeah, six again, because it's also a symmetric spatial tensor. So total degrees of freedom is 6 plus 6, or 12. So that means that we need to specify 8 degrees of freedom, right? So we specify 8 degrees of freedom, then we can solve the constraints for 4 more, and then we will fully specify gamma ij and kij. So the common approach, which is what we're going to use today, is to basically write the write the spatial metric as some conformal metric, which we can freely specify, and then some conformal factor, some overall rescaling, which we can solve the Hamiltonian constraint for. And we'll do something similar to the momentum constraint as well. This is kind of nice in the sense that if our conformal metric is, we can freely specify that, and if it's kind of close to being a solution of the constraints, then we'll just get back that this conformal factor is close to one, so we'll kind of get back what we put in. But if it sort of violates the Hamiltonian constraint, then we'll get back some non-unity conformal factor. So I'll write that out explicitly in just a second. But because we're going to be working with these conformal transformations, we're going to need some expressions for basically how to write covariant derivatives and Christoffel symbols and when you do a conformal transformation. So I'm not going to work that out. I'll just write down the expression. But if you want to see the details, you can see, for example, Appendix G and Carroll, or Chapter 6. All right, so this is, if we consider some general conformal transformation of our metric, so here I'll just write down the kind of n-dimensional expression, and then we'll specialize to the spatial case. So if we have GAB n-dimensional, and then we write it as some conformal factor here, omega squared, and then we use tilde for our kind of conformal metric. Then yeah, then basically the Christoffel symbols kind of defined with respect to this metric won't be the same as the ones with this conformal metric, but you can write down an expression for the difference between the two of them. Okay, so this is, and here, again, this tilde means sort of the covariant derivative, but defined in terms of this tilde GAB as opposed to the regular one. So for scalar derivatives, there's no difference because the covariant derivative is the same as the partial derivative. But once we get to vector covariant derivatives, things get more complicated. So if we have the tilde here, we're going to pick up some extra terms. Okay, and finally, we can also define, we're also going to need the Ricci curvature and its relation from the one defined in terms of this and the one defined in terms of the tilde, the conformally rescaled ones. So basically, from this expression, if you crunch through the math in the definition of the Riemann tensor, get the following. All right, so anyway, those are just some mathematical expressions. Can check this reference for details, and we're going to use those in rewriting our constraint equations. And we're going to specialize to the n equals 3 case because we're interested in spatial derivative or the spatial tensors. So our goal is going to be to perform what's called the conformal transverse traceless decomposition. Of our spatial tensors. So we'll get to all these different adjectives one by one. But we'll begin by defining this conformal rescaling of the spatial metric. So here, instead of using this omega squared, I'm actually going to use the conformal variable psi and let it be a fourth power, and we'll see in a second why it's most convenient to choose this to be a fourth power. Of course, it's just the definition. Yeah, and basically, as I alluded to earlier, this gamma tilde ij is going to be our free data, and the psi, the conformal factor, is going to be the one that we're going to solve for. So if we just specialize to this case and plug those into the expressions over there, we get the following. For the spatial Ricci curvature, Okay. And we notice actually this last term here, we square that, we get a 4 times the 2, that's an 8. And then we get psi squared times that is psi to the minus 6. So actually that just cancels out with this term here, right? 2 times 4 is 8. So these cancel out. And that kind of explains why we chose this psi to the 4. So we get this nice simpler form for the Ricci curvature. Oh, sorry. No. All right. Cancels out with this one. Yeah, because it's the mixed derivatives. So we just get that term left. Yeah, and we're going to kind of continue that pattern where we'll choose sort of convenient powers for these conformal rescalings, either to make the equations simpler or some nicer form, or to have some certain mathematical properties that enforce some physical constraints when you write down the equations. Yeah, so that's this conformal rescaling of the spatial tensor, and we get this expression for the Ricci curvature, and we'll put that into the Hamiltonian constraint in a second. But before we do that, let's start decomposing the extrinsic curvature as well. So as advertised by this traceless adjective, we're going to do decomposition into a part that's trace-free and the trace. So this is trace-free by construction, and we're going to let the trace of the extrinsic curvature also be free data. And then now we're going to further decompose this trace-free part. So first we're going to conformally rescale it. So this is just the definition of what I'm calling a hat, and we'll see where this 10 comes from in a second. Again, it's just going to be make our equation simpler. So if we take this and this and this and combine that into our Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, so just emphasize again, all these tildes mean the covariant derivative and the Ricci tensor and so on defined with respect to this gamma tilde. But here you can see that our our Hamiltonian constraint is beginning to look just like a Laplace equation, right? Basically, this is just the Laplace operator acting on psi, and then we have some terms that don't involve higher derivatives, right, of psi. So this is sort of an elliptic form for the conformal factor that we can work with. So basically we're kind of done with our Hamiltonian constraint, but we still have more work to do on the momentum constraint. So maybe this is a good place to end here. So any questions about that? Yeah, tomorrow we'll basically further decompose this a hat and then write down the momentum constraint in a way that's kind of like a vector Laplace type equation. And then we'll give some examples of solutions to these equations. Okay, well, yeah, in your tutorial, you'll get to do some more of these conformal rescalings when you write down the BSSN equations. Okay, well, stick around if anyone has questions.